AutoLine After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, your journey, our passion, and by Chevrolet, Chevy runs deep.
This is AutoLine After Hours with John McElroy, episode 134 for January 19th, 2012, London Calling. Watch AutoLine After Hours live at AutoLine.tv every Thursday at 7 p.m. Eastern or 2400 hours GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for AutoLine After Hours in the iTunes Store.
Peter.
John.
We're here, man.
Again.
Again.
Again and again.
And again and again. So lots to talk about today. We should let everybody know that in about 10 minutes or so, Carl Ludvigsen, author, journalist, designer, public relations guy, a whole bunch of other things, will be joining us from London. Well, not really London, but we'll call it London. That's close enough.
Over there.
Right. So what's hit you this week? What's really stood out for you, Peter?
Well, let's see. My column was about auto show aftermath, and that seemed to piss a whole new bunch of people off.
And why? Explain why.
Well, I don't know. I think, I just was kind of amazed that so many people weigh in on the auto show who weren't actually there to see the vehicles in person, you know. The Fusion seems to have cut through, and people agree that that looks pretty cool. Mm-hmm. The Lincoln seems to be getting a lot of grief, again, from people who haven't seen it in person. And right. I kind of don't quite understand. And everyone is weighing in on the Lincoln on that one concept. And this is a long road. I mean, Ford executives know this is a decade-long proposition. So.
Right.
This is just the first volley, and it's the tip of the iceberg of a monumental push within Ford to take revive Lincoln and get it going again. So, I don't know. There's a lot going on this week in regard to the after show, aftermath.
Yeah. No, I heard some negative feedback on the Ford MKZ. And, you know, we've been talking it up for months here. But I agree with you, as we've talked about before. You got to see these things out on the road in the natural light with other cars around them. And then you'll get a much better view of what the car is really about.
Yeah. And Ford's paying executive bonuses again. That just came out. That was pretty interesting.
Yeah. Well, you know, in another couple of weeks, they'll report their financial earnings for last year. And it's going to be a big number. I mean, a big number. So, yeah, they ought to be getting bonuses. Why not? Of course. They earned it.
So what's on your mind?
Well, the thing that I thought was interesting is the National Academy of Sciences came out yesterday and said, you know all those problems Toyota had with sudden unintended acceleration? It was driver error. And you know, we've been saying that all along here, and that now some people have said, oh, well, there's these electronic gremlins, and even the National Academy said, yeah, there is some weird stuff that happens with electronics. In fact, the specific term that they refer to it as tin whiskers, and they're like these super microscopic things that can happen in electronics. But as we pointed out with unintended acceleration, two things. Number one, it overwhelmingly occurs with older drivers. And I know this is not PC to say, but older women drivers especially. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is unintended acceleration as a problem has been around for decades. It, you know, affected Audi well before there was ever electronic throttle control. In fact, it even precedes any electronics in cars whatsoever. So,
and as we said, there was never any report of it with a manual transmission. Gee, how does that work?
Right.
Yeah, so they just confirm what we had already known, but they have to beat it to death. And then,
well, you know, it's the professional car suers, you know, the people who make a living out of going around suing car companies, who absolutely need to have some sort of mysterious gremlin so that they can go after the automakers. And look, I'm not against going after automakers when they cause problems, because they do. They make mistakes.
Sure.
They have stuff that's not well built or not well designed. But this unintended acceleration stuff is just so bogus. And I really learned so much about it back when it hit Audi in 1987. In fact, I stopped watching 60 Minutes, the television program, because they did such a hack job on Audi and never apologized for it, never rescinded anything that they said that was so bogus.
But yeah.
Anyway, I thought that was rather interesting.
Yes, I thought that was interesting. I thought it was interesting, too, that the head of Porsche said they aren't going to jump into this smaller sports car jointly developed with Audi and Volkswagen, that they're going to sort of take a break from that and wait that out. And I was just like, wow, that was really good. Because, you know, Porsche has sort of been operating under the equation, more models equals more money. But I have to applaud them for saying, you know what, we're going to pull back from that. Because I'm sorry, but I don't like the words jointly developed with Audi and Volkswagen and the word Porsche in the same sentence. I mean, if Porsche is going to survive as this entity, if they're going to sell Cayennes and Panameras in order to build the cool stuff, then I think it's pretty visionary on the head of Porsche's part to say, you know, we're going to give that a rest. We're not going to dive into that.
So in fact, when we get Carl Ludvigsen in, we're going to have to ask him about it, because he wrote what I think is the definitive book on Porsche.
Well, my favorite, the book that probably did more to get me excited about, you know, the possibility of writing about cars was Excellence Was Expected, the Porsche story, which is my favorite car book of all time. So,
yeah, well, we'll bring this up again when we get him on. One other thing I wanted to talk about, because I thought that this was extraordinary. At the Consumer Electronics Show, Audi introduced a new technology called Traffic Jam Assist. So you know about cruise control, and you know about adaptive cruise control. Well, this is the next step, where the car not only speeds up and slows down automatically, it also does the steering. So it'll steer around pedestrians or other cars that are conked out on the freeway. And I think that is mind-blowing, because typically when Audi shows anything, 18, 24 months later, it's in production. So,
yeah, you know, I you're big on this.
I am.
These, you know, eventually we'll pull into the city limits of urban centers and flip a switch and be guided into our parking space.
Right.
And, you know, that's cool. I guess.
I know you don't like it, but I think it's the next big thing in the automotive industry, because I think so many people, whether they're disabled or elderly or very young, I mean, you know, like kids. I don't mean like teenage kids. I mean even younger than that, grade school, will be able to use an automobile.
Yeah.
That's why I think it's going to be a huge thing.
I can see it in urban centers, just to relieve the traffic, the congestion, the accordion effect and all that. I mean, it could be kind of freaky if everyone's going 65, 70 miles an hour and doing all this stuff. And
yeah. Well, the stuff that Audi is, this traffic jam assist technology, will be designed to work only at speeds up to 60 kilometers an hour, which is like 37, 38 miles an hour, something like that. So, supposedly you're only supposed to use it in stop and go traffic jam kind of situations.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
Well, hey, why don't we take a quick commercial break, and then why don't we get Carl Ludvigsen in here?
Okay, cool.
Ben, let's take the first commercial break. Well, Carl Ludvigsen, time to have you join us here on Autoline After Hours. And it's so good to see you staying up past midnight in England to be with us right now.
It's a pleasure to be with you. I don't mind at all. It's really great.
So, Carl, how should we describe you? Just so in case anybody out there listening doesn't know who you are, what are you?
Well, I spent about, more than a decade with General Motors and Fiat Motors of North America and Ford of Europe. So I've worked in the industry over the years, and I've edited car magazines. I've been a freelance writer for years, working on all kinds of projects. And I spent 15 years here in London running a motor industry management consultancy, dealing with problems of car makers, accessory makers, government bodies, European Union, et cetera, which was very, very interesting. So I guess I've kind of tried to cover the waterfront.
And done so pretty well, too. And
Carl, you knew my dad pretty well because you were with GMPR when my dad was there, correct?
Peter, I certainly did. Yeah. I was very, very proud and pleased to be working for Tony. It was a great, great time for General Motors PR in those days.
Yeah,
Well, we had a lot to work with. We had a great company, and all we really had to do was portray it as it was. Although, of course, when I think about it, we got into when I was there, the Ralph Nader period was beginning. So a number of different things were going on. That Corvair was in trouble. So we had a few things to deal with, and some we dealt with pretty well. Others perhaps not so well.
Yeah, actually, it's funny you mentioned that. We were just talking about that. That when, unbeknownst to my dad, who was in charge of General Motors PR at the time, investigators were hired in Washington to tail Nader. And I remember my dad telling me that the meeting where they discovered that the investigators were hired by someone on the GM legal staff, unbeknownst to my dad, that was a very tense meeting. And then, of course, that basically changed the shape of the automobile industry for good because it made Ralph Nader and it created the push for the safety agency.
Peter, it did, and we in our department, press relations, Tom Groen and company, we did try. Carlton Breckler was active in it. We tried to alert management to the importance of unsafe at any speed. We did our darndest to alert the company to the fact that this was not just another little thing that was going to blow over. I don't think we quite got the message across, but, you know, you can only try as hard as you can, really.
And
In fact, I want to weigh in because sure. I told Peter, because we were talking about this before we started the show, that I don't think that story's ever come out. Yes, we know, of course, that GM hired these detectives to follow Ralph Nader, but I don't think the inside story of what was going on inside GM and what Peter's saying here, I think, is explosive, that the head of public relations at General Motors was unaware that this was taking place, and other high-level members of management were unaware of it.
Yeah,
they were completely unaware. This was, as Peter said, action taken by a lady on the legal staff. Several levels down on our own initiative to say, oh gosh, we really ought to find out a little more about this guy Nader and see if, you know, what he's up to.
But her big boss knew about it and didn't tell anyone, Aloysius Powers.
Oh yeah.
And knew about it, and then my dad told me about that meeting one morning when, I guess, I don't know, you might have heard, but from what I understood, the Washington Post called, or somebody from the Washington Post called my dad directly and said, "Are you aware of this?"
All right. Okay.
And he said, "What?" Well, he initially, of course, denied it because he couldn't imagine this was going on. And then, of course, there was a tense meeting where it came out. Like you said, legal staff took it upon themselves, didn't tell anyone.
Yep.
And it created Ralph Nader. And then my dad was the one who had to tell Jim Roach that you have to go to Washington to this hearing and publicly apologize.
Yeah, that was just excruciating. And there was no finer gentleman in the motor industry at any time than Jim Roach. I mean, he really was a sincere and wonderfully well-meaning person in every respect. So for him to have to be put in that position was just appalling.
And he was, what, chairman of the company at the time?
Oh, yes. Yes, yeah. He sure was.
Right.
Yeah, Jim Roach was a very good guy, and you're exactly right. Very humble, unassuming guy, you know.
And here we are, you know, half a century later, and the story's coming out here on Out of Line After Hours tonight. I think General Motors would have been seen in a much better light if the public had been aware that, hey, this was like rogue executives operating on their own to hire these dicks to tail Nader.
Yeah, yeah.
No, I don't want to take up too much of your time, but there is just a mini story here, which is that when I was at Sports Cars Illustrated, I did the launch road test on the Corvair, and I said the Corvair is at heart a profoundly oversteering car. You know, the rear end wants to get ahead of the front end. And I said that in print. And by the time all of this came out, of course, and the Nader era was upon us, there I was working at General Motors in public relations. And the legal guys were petrified that somehow, somebody on the other side would figure this out, that they had me working at GM. But luckily, that nobody ever made that connection.
Yeah, I don't know if a lot of the viewers have seen the book or heard about the book, but Carl, your book on Porsche, the definitive book on Porsche, Excellence Was Expected, really charged me and inspired me to, do something about writing about cars. And I think how many times have you updated it?
Well, I think we've updated Excellence now three times, going on four. It's valid up to 2008, I think, at the moment, and we're getting ready to do another update. It's now about 1 million words, three volumes, 1,600 pages, so you get your money's worth with Excellence Was Expected.
Yeah, so if any of your listeners or viewers out there have never checked it out, it's fabulous. But
say the name again.
Excellence Was Expected, the story of... is there a subtitle to it? I don't
know. No, it's just Porsche. Excellence Was Expected.
Yeah, and my favorite was the first volume because, it's just fascinating. And it took us through what year, the first one?
Well, in 1948 when they created the first Type 356. And just a little word to my fans out there. I've got a new book coming out, Porsche, The Origin of the Species. And for the first time, we really have gone into what actually happened in the very, very early days, how and why the 356 came out like it did, the role of the Swiss entrepreneurs who backed the project, the involvement of Cisitalia, how that influenced the 356. Cool. So we've got a heck of a story coming in the spring, I think, from Bentley Publishers.
Fantastic.
What year did the first Excellence, what year did it go up to?
We published it in 1978, so right up to about that time. That was the original book.
But, 800, I love the, my favorite parts of the book, because one of my favorite all-time race cars was the 908.
Mm-hmm. Mine was the 917.
Yeah, the 908 Spider, if I'm not mistaken, Piëch was instrumental in that car. Is that correct?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Ferdinand Piëch was
a brilliant engineer
of technical side at Porsche. Helmut Bott was his deputy. And between them, they did some astounding things. Beryllium, brake discs, I mean, you name it. they had technology up the gazoo.
What do you make of Porsche these days? And you must have heard Peter and I talking earlier about passing on doing a shared sports car with Volkswagen and Audi.
I'm pretty impressed with what Porsche is doing. They are finding ways to work more economically so that their cars can be sold profitably, which they are. They emphasize these days passion and excitement rather than technology, which is a way to appeal to a much broader audience. But to their great credit, the cars are still tremendous to drive. So the engineers at Weissach are not letting down the side. They're clearly defending the characteristic of Porsche, which is the ultimate driver's car, in my opinion, and producing, really exciting cars to drive and enjoyable cars to drive. So I'm I'm impressed with the way they've managed to balance the need to economize and to share parts within their activity. As Peter said, they don't want to go outside any more than they have to. Obviously, with the Cayenne, they did share some things with Volkswagen. That's worked out pretty well. They couldn't have done it otherwise. But generally, they found ways to share components within the company and among a wide range of models, which is pretty clever, very, very ingenious stuff. So darn good. They're doing a good job.
I think it'll get better, too, because they're growing like crazy in China. And in fact, I know they've got an internal goal of doubling sales, not necessarily just in China, but, you know,
globally.
Exactly right. So as profitable and successful as they are right now, it could double within this decade.
That would be a big ask, but half again, maybe, you know, by mid-decade, half again, probably. And yes, end of decade, they could double, no question.
Or close to it.
Right? And to your point, Carl, about Porsche, you know, they're pretty ingenious in what they do. And the new 911 has a 7-speed manual gearbox that's basically a modification of the 7-speed PDK. And
yeah.
I think that's pretty radical stuff right there. And so they're still on their game.
I agree 100% to Peter. They are very much on their game. They've got to balance the relationship with Volkswagen, of course. And the position there is that the merger, the full merger of the companies, isn't happening. There have been some legal challenges to the idea of a merger between the two companies, which was on the agenda. Technically, they should have done it already, but it's been put off now for several years because there are a number of legal issues to be overcome. And they said publicly, no, we're not going to be doing it right away.
But, Carl, don't you think that's more of a legal issue, and that when it comes to actual the hardware end of the business, there is massive cooperation with Volkswagen Group and Porsche, and it's the Porsche holding company that's got these legal issues?
Yes, I agree. I don't think it's going to affect the actual operation. I think it does, you know, the tragedy of what happened with Porsche is that it did lose its independence. I mean, and Ferry Porsche fought like tooth and nail for decades to maintain Porsche's independence in spite of many attempts by Volkswagen to undermine it. And, of course, Wedeking, in his hubris, managed to create a situation where Porsche lost its independence, and that was a catastrophe. It hasn't worked out badly for the family. The PX and Porsches are doing very well out of it all, thank you. Wolfgang Porsche is head of the supervisory board at Porsche. So the family is still very much involved, but they want to keep their distance as much as they can, and the fact that a full merger hasn't happened at least allows them a modicum of independence.
Mm-hmm. So, Carl, over here stateside, we're all wondering what's going on with Europe and the European industry especially. And there's more talk these days, literally just in the last couple of weeks, of more mergers taking place there, more consolidation.
We had that call to arms from Sergio Marchionne during the show. He said that he feels that we really need consolidation, especially in Europe. And except for Volkswagen, we don't have a big European car company. They're all medium-sized auto companies. Of course, Opel and Ford are integrated with their American parents, but we really could do with some additional consolidation. And the main wild cards, if you will, are the two French companies, Renault and Peugeot Citroën.
But don't you think Renault is really taken care of now that it's tied up with Nissan, or now that it essentially acquired Nissan?
Yes. I think that's right. And I think, John, for that reason, Renault's probably not a candidate for consolidation right now. There's still a small golden share owned by the French government. That complicates things. So PSA is the one that could play a role maybe in a consolidation in Europe. There is already some cooperation between PSA and Fiat in commercial vehicles. They share a number of projects, light commercials and so on. So I think that's kind of the way Mr. Marchionne is probably thinking. By the way, speaking of that, you know, you have the new Dodge Dart at the show, which is based on an Alfa Romeo chassis. It looks pretty good, actually. And here in the UK, we have, believe it or not, the Chrysler Delta and Ypsilon. Now, you may not be aware that these are being sold in Britain, but they're launches, aren't they? I mean, they're the launch of Ypsilon and Delta, and they've been launched through the Chrysler dealer organization in the UK. So far, people are kind of looking around in a bemused manner, trying to figure out what to make of this initiative. Lancia, of course, since rust problems in the 1980s, has had a black mark against it in the British market. So this is a way of sneaking some Lancias in under the Chrysler nameplate. But it's hard to tell whether it's going to work out.
Yeah, in fact, we've got Deltas running around on the streets of Detroit, where our new studio is here. Just up the road is a big TRW electronics plant. And there's a Lancia Delta parked in the parking lot there every day. So clearly they must have some contract to help homologate it for American emission or fuel economy standards or something like that. But, the Delta's coming to the American market.
Yeah. That's strange, little odd-looking car. You know it when you see it, which is good. Nothing
right,
wrong with that.
Right.
You want to be visible. But you're right. Consolidation is a theme, and another theme, of course, is GM's struggle to get profitable. They're just not profitable, and of course, you know, in recent history, GM tried to sell its European operations. Changed its mind, said, okay, we'll hang on to it. Instead, we're going to make a go of it. We're not going to sell it to Frank Stronach and Magna. We're going to press on, see what we can do. And so far, they're still struggling. The cars are good, but they don't really have a senior model that rakes in the big bucks, you know, something with a big profit margin. They're stuck dealing in the tough segments, really, where pricing is crucial. So one of the things they're talking about right now is trying to bring some production from Korea back to Europe. And be making in the European plants some of the cars that are assembled in Korea. So they could be making Chevrolets, for example. You know, I was astounded to realize that a quarter of GM's production comes from Korea. I mean, crikey, I hadn't realized that. So I can, and people are saying, gee, we're selling a lot of these Chevrolets in Europe now. Maybe we ought to be making some of them there. And of course, Opel's got, and Vauxhall have got some plants that have spare capacity. And if you can utilize the capacity better, you can maybe have a hope of making some money. So that's a theme. And GM is just opening discussions with the unions in Korea right now. And, of course, the Korean unions are not pushovers.
No, they're
like
as
Japan.
Militant as IG Metall.
Oh, no.
Maybe more militant. They might be the most militant unions in the world, the ones in South Korea.
They're serious. They can shut you down. So it's going to be interesting to see how that plays out. But that is a big preoccupation right now, to see if they can shift some production to help the rentability of the European plants.
Well, of course, you know, I've always said that the problem in fixing Opel is not getting hard-nosed business managers in there making tough decisions. They've had people trying to do that. It's that this is a political minefield. that to close plants and lay off people in Europe, particularly in Germany, is a political problem, not necessarily a management problem.
John, you couldn't be more right. They did succeed in closing the plant at Antwerp, GM Continental. I mean, it was a struggle, but they did. You know, you can do it in Europe, but you've got a ritual to follow. You have to start with certain assumptions. You have to tell the unions. You've got a long, long process of information and acquiescence and so on. You've got to tick a lot of boxes in order to do it properly. Of course, Antwerp, Belgium, is very close to the EU and Brussels, and so it's a very sensitive area. But they did manage it. So they are trying to consolidate some plants if they possibly can.
Jumping topics here completely, Carl. We had Jim Hall in here last week on the show, and he said one of his fondest memories of all time is you driving him around London. I think he said around Hyde Park in a Lancia Stratos. And he said, be sure to ask Carl if he still has the Stratos.
I no longer have the Stratos. It was terrific. Another guy you might want to talk to is Herb Fischel, the former GM head of performance. I drove Herb back to his hotel in the Stratos through the streets of London, and he still can't stop talking about it. It was a fabulous car. It was a fabulous car, and I enjoyed it for a long time. But when I went out from London on one of the motorways and I was passed by a Ford Escort Turbo with four people in it, I thought, well, okay, it was good for a while, but it's time to move on. So I thought it really was tremendous. I enjoyed driving it a lot. It was a great, great machine.
And for our viewers and listeners out there, Carl, explain, the Stratos was this magnificent short wheelbase, mid-engine, lightweight vehicle that was developed primarily for rallying. Is that correct?
It was, Peter. It was developed specifically for rallying and from scratch by Bertone, working with Lancia, motorsports people, Cesare Fiorio and his team. Lancia itself really had no idea what to do about the Stratos. It was something that Fiorio wanted, and he managed to get it organized and get it built. And it was styled by Gandini. It's a little wedge type machine with a windscreen like a jet fighter.
Yeah, it was beautiful. It's a beautiful.
And it
car.
Had there was not any single part of the car that didn't have to be there. There was nothing extra on the Stratos. It was absolutely paired to the essentials and a terrific machine to drive. And when I joined Fiat Motors of North America in 1978, my first priority was to get my hands on a Stratos. I thought, there must still be, they were built and sold in the early 70s, and I thought there must still be some around that I could get my hands on. And Lancia did come up with one. They had one that was used for show and display, and they were finished with it. So that's how I got my hands on one. It was fabulous.
And it had Ferrari power, and it was how much did it weigh? Like 1,800 pounds?
I know less than that. I think it was. It had the Ferrari Dino V6 in it. That's right, Peter. No, it was just enough, and it was a great little car. I'm very, very pleased to have had it.
Well, I've got a fond spot in my heart for that Stratos too, because little known story, in 1971, and I think 1970 as well, the World Rally Championship every year came to Michigan, because there was a rally in the Upper Peninsula of the state called the Press On Regardless Rally that for a few years there
was an FIA event.
Event, and you could earn points for the World Rally Championship. So to get publicity for it, They held the first stage on Belle Isle in Detroit.
Oh, I remember that.
And then after they did the first stage, they all hop on I-75 and go up into the Upper Peninsula. But I went down to Belle Isle to see the first stage of the rally, and the Lancia team was there. And, boy, I can still see it in my mind right now of there's a couple of bridges on the island, not leading to the island, but on the island itself that are sort of humps. And these things were getting airborne like I've never seen a car get in the air. And I'm a kid in high school at the time, man, and I'm just, like, eating this stuff up. And I have never forgotten the Lancia Stratos because of that.
It was terrific. As you said, custom-built for rallying. That was the so it was extremely agile, light, good traction, great vision, great visibility. Had it all, really. There was an attempt recently to create and market a modern sort of updated Stratos. It was based on a Ferrari chassis, if I'm not mistaken. What I've heard lately is that it's not happening. There are companies in the UK that make very, very acceptable replica Stratos cars right at the moment. So, you know, if you still itch for one, you can have a pretty darn good facsimile.
Carl, anything that you own now or wish you did own that's really stand out?
Oh, I have a 1935 French Talbot sports saloon, which we've just recently acquired, and we have a post-war Riley sports car, two-seater Riley sports car. So that's keeping us pretty busy at the moment. Nothing, and my runaround car is an Audi TT, and I just love that car. It's just a terrific machine, just great for what we need it for over here.
Yeah.
Couldn't be better.
To another commercial break.
Yeah, why don't we take another commercial break here, and then we can chat a bit and get into rapid fire. But, Ben, let's give a shout-out to our friends at, who do we have now? Chevrolet, I think.
It was more than a car to him. It really was his baby.
Oh, no. That's my old Chevy. Dear God.
So, Carl, what do you see from afar over here? What do you like in the U.S. Companies right
yeah,
now?
Yeah, I had a look at what was happening at the show, and I agree with you that the Fusion looks like the real deal. I mean, I think they sweated the details on that car in a way that you don't often see from the American makers. That's where the Americans tend to fall down. They say, okay, that's good enough. You know, yeah. go with that. But in the case of the Fusion, clearly they decided they wanted it to be good, all good. And it is all good as far as I can tell. And we're quite excited over here because it's the Mondeo of the future for Europe.
Right.
The only apprehension that people have over here about it is that it was developed in America. So Ford cars in Europe and in the UK in particular have a reputation for outstanding handling and ride characteristics. That's something that they're very respected for. Since Richard Perry Jones was here, and he brought that ethic to Ford, and his successors have been good at maintaining it. So there's a lot of worry about, you know, oh, gee, it was developed by a bunch of Americans. What do they know about, you know, driving in the European environment? So, and we've had a lot of assurances, don't worry, it's going to be good, even though Americans created it. So we're keeping our fingers crossed about that.
Well, you know, I would remind those people that the head of design for passenger cars in North America is Murray Callum, who happens to hail from the UK. And if you look at, you know, Ford's engineering staff, I mean, it looks like the United Nations. So I'm pleased to see that it was designed and developed in the U.S., though I recognize that it was from people all over, because my fear was that Ford was going to only do pickup trucks and SUVs in the U.S. and never do cars anymore and rely largely on the European operations to do all the passenger cars. So I'm glad to see that they're mixing it up a bit.
That's really good. I agree. Another car that we're going to share between the U.S. and Europe is the little Buick Encore, which is going to be the Opel and Vauxhall, I think, Mocha, a little SUV type vehicle. And or what is it? A small SUV? Not SUV.
It's crossover.
MPV, a mini MPV.
Or we even call them CUVs.
I must admit, I've only seen the pictures of it, but I think it is an Encore. It's an Encore of the Aztec. I think it's the Aztec of the 21st century. The
Encore. A lot of people don't like the way it looks.
I can't believe the amount of contorted sheet metal that there is on this little car. There isn't a square inch of it that isn't being tortured in some really terrible way. I think they ought to call it the Opel Hippo when they bring it over. It's a really distressing looking automobile. And nobody has said anything bad about it, but I must admit, I find it quite alarming, really.
Well, they tried to capture the visual appeal of the Enclave on a smaller scale, and it just doesn't work. Because it's a larger vehicle, something you don't see over there, but the Enclave is quite a striking vehicle.
Very good looking.
Very good looking design, and you know, they tried to shrink it down, and it just doesn't work.
It doesn't work. It doesn't work at all. And I spent a lot of time with Bill Mitchell in the old days, and of course Bill said, you know, these small cars, it's like tailoring a dwarf. You know, he said it's not that easy to make it work. And this is one that, in my view, doesn't work.
Well, Bill was a neighbor of ours, and I rode in. He gave me rides in every significant GM concept car of the early 60s, and he was a piece of work. I'm sure you have some interesting stories.
Oh, no. Bill was great. He was a great, great friend and a great mentor to me. Very, very, very important man in my life, Bill Mitchell.
Carl, is that where
I
find that fascinating. That was a part of your career that I really wasn't aware of, that you did design work.
Well, I was. I joined GM design staff in 1956. I worked in an experimental studio. I went in there straight from Pratt Institute and worked with Bob McLean and on the team that did the Firebirds. So I had a little interval there, and then I went into journalism for a while. And Bill Mitchell basically hired me out of that career to join the GM's public relations staff, and I was Bill's PR man for, gosh, 3 years or 3 or 4 years, something like that.
That was a special assignment, Carl. I mean, that's hanging out with one of the icons of the business.
Well, I was basically, Peter, hired over your dad's dead body. The PR staff had no thought of hiring a guy with my background at all. That wasn't on their agenda in any way, shape, or form. But Bill Mitchell just insisted on it. He said, you have a lot of guys who can mix martinis and, you know, talk to people and so on, but you don't have anybody who knows anything about cars, and I can't communicate with people the way I want to without having somebody who knows about cars working with me. So people down at West Grand Boulevard gulped and said, "Oh, okay, Bill, we'll get a guy like that."
So what years were you with Bill, Carl?
It was 1961 to 64.
And I mean, those were some of the best years.
Oh, yeah. It was great. It was great. Corvette coming out, Stingray. And
the battle with Zorro over the Stingray, the split window and all that.
That's it. No, it was fabulous. And yes, I mean, in a public relations position, you are constantly asking people in the company for help, and you're asking people for help all throughout the company. And every time I went somewhere to carry out some research or take a press guy to see something, I was met with the greatest courtesy and expertise that you could possibly ask for. And in those days, GM was that kind of company. It had everywhere great experts and knowledgeable people who were able to you know, spend some time explaining to you what the heck they were doing. And so that was extremely satisfying.
Hey, this is probably a good time where let's go to the audience, Carl, for the rapid fire segment and get some questions from them. So, Ben, let's launch rapid fire. Okay. This is where we get all the questions from the audience and try to answer them rapidly, but they don't always get answered rapidly. Brian Young wants to know, with Peugeot's departure from Le Mans, do you see any company stepping up to battle Audi? And if not, what company would you like to see battle Audi? Carl, we'll start with you.
Well, it looks like Porsche is going to get back into the big time of sports car racing. So, yes, I think we see a competitor coming from Porsche at long last. They were in, you know, they're in the second rank of GT2, and I think they're going up to GT1 now. So we're going to see Porsche in there, and I think for the Japanese, Le Mans is unfinished business. We may see one of the Japanese companies coming up to the to mount a challenge, and I think Audi's going to take some time off too. So Audi will probably only field private teams rather than a factory team, I would imagine. So we'll see a little bit of a change in the quite exciting in the Daytona prototypes too, with Chevrolet coming in with a great looking new Corvette lookalike Daytona prototype. So, and that's good news, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, you know, Peugeot just announced they're pulling out. Toyota is going to have an LMP car at the end of the season. And I think you're right, Carl. Audi's going to step aside and go big in the GT ranks because Porsche will enter the top prototype class. And so I think we'll see Toyota and Porsche battling and hopefully another manufacturer for the top spots in 2013 and 14.
Yeah, well, I'm sorry to see Peugeot drop out. I hope they get back in.
Yeah.
George from Brooklyn wants to know, Carl, is the Porsche Cajun a good idea?
The Porsche Cajun... Well, it may be a step too far in the in the proliferation of the Porsche range, but you know they as they did with the Cayenne, they'll position it in a unique way. I mean, they have a way of making a car that carves out its own special niche, and if they manage that as well as they did the Cayenne, then I think it'll be okay. Yeah, that's a vehicle that they would be counting on big time to achieve the production goals that we spoke about earlier. Mm-hmm. So yes, I think they can do it. I think they can do it.
You know, I actually think and maybe you know this, but I was told that the Porsche engineering team didn't really have enough time with the original Cayenne. And that the most recent revision to it speaks more to their input. You know, it's 450 pounds lighter. It's dynamically much better. And so I expect the Cayenne, as I was told by Porsche, is probably going to be a much more aggressive and sporty crossover. So that should be interesting.
Yeah, that could be pretty good. Let's see here. Next question. DC Auto Geek wants to know, what are your thoughts on recent reports that Ford will put up $400 million to build a prototype to build America's next military Humvee, the Joint Light Tactical Vehicle? Any thoughts? I guess I got thoughts on this. The Detroit automakers used to be heavily involved in the defense industry, and it's been a long time since they were involved there. And now the big question is, because the military is keen on this, can you take off-the-shelf mass production parts and make a military vehicle out of it? The military suppliers right now will tell you absolutely not. They just will not stand up to battlefield conditions. But the Army's pushing this idea. I find it intriguing that Ford wants to get into this. And, of course, it's big money if you land the contract that goes on for many, many years. Because look at the Humvees that we're using right now. I still remember sitting in the prototype at Jeep Truck Engineering on Plymouth Road in 1980. Here it is 2012, and we're still using the vehicle that I sat in, you know, so many years ago. So anyway, I find it intriguing that Ford's looking at getting into this.
That is interesting, and I commend them for that. As you rightly say, also, John, it has spinoff potential. You know, you could be making a civilian vehicle that you could close the loop and bring something civilian out from the basis of what you're doing. So that looks like they have the money to do it, and it's a good place to invest it, I think.
It'll be fascinating to watch that. Okay, George wants to know, are there any plans for a Cadillac ATS coupe?
Yes.
There you got the answer.
There's also a wagon.
Well, this is good. This is good because I, in a blog, everybody was talking about this new little Cadillac, and I said, it's not going to achieve the goals that the company has for it without more body styles. And I hadn't heard anything from the show about the body styles. So, Peter, I'm glad to hear that that's on the agenda because, they need them, and they need them now. They don't need them, in 2014. They need them immediately. So I hope they're coming soon in the lineup.
And, Carl, wouldn't you add they need a diesel engine if they want to be a serious player in Europe at all?
Absolutely. It's essential. No question, John.
What's the penetration rate of diesels in the luxury segment in Europe right now?
Oh, luxury segment, you're half, better than half.
Going to say 80%.
Yeah, it's probably as high as
very high, 70% easily.
Yeah.
Okay, JF from Quebec says, why is it the Chinese elite is so in love with stretched cars?
I don't really know. I know that's a big deal there, that they like to be driven, and that's part of their...
They're in the back seat.
Yeah.
I got to tell you, if you want to make a presence, there's nothing like showing up in a big, long car than an Italy dinky little short one. So I think that's what it's... It's about prestige and having lots of room in the back seat. Let's see. John Saar says, when I saw the teaser pictures and then got to see the full Dodge Dart, the thing I kept saying is, if you have never seen an Alfa Giulietta, you will like the Dart. He seems to be damning the Dart with faint praise here. Carl, you're very familiar with the Giulietta, and you said earlier that you thought the Dart looked pretty good.
I did. I thought they'd come up with a pretty reasonable interpretation of a Dodge, for that class of car. But, clearly they want to differentiate with Alfa. The plans to bring Alfa Romeo back to the United States are still cooking away somewhere in the Fiat organization. Something I hope they will only do when they are really ready to come with excellent cars. Alfa Romeo is the potential Italian BMW, but it's been a case of potential now for many decades. And I just hope they do one day crack it, because Alfa deserves to have a substantial role in the world motor industry. So, they may have sacrificed a bit in order to maintain Alfa's distinctive look for the Giulietta, not to give it to Dodge.
Carl, let me ask you some of your tenure at GM with Bill Mitchell. What was your favorite concept back then, or what was your favorite car back then from GM?
Oh, the Stingray racing car.
The original Stingray is my all-time favorite car.
Oh, are you kidding?
Yeah.
I on a number of occasions, had the chance to demonstrate that car to visitors to the tech center and to styling staff, and boy, did I love, going around those roads through the tech center. You know, I had my own little circuit
that
I used.
Little-known fact, in the tech center, they had that ride and handling loop.
Oh, yeah. Well, I didn't use that. I just used the roads around the tech center,
yeah.
which were good enough. And, you know, past the climate control center and then around the back. And it was terrific. And I remember Kenny Eschebach one time.
Who was brilliant, by the way. Ken was a brilliant craftsman.
Yeah. When I brought the car back to the garage, he said, "You really love that car, don't you?" I said, "I certainly do, Ken."
It's tremendous. Yeah, it's my all-time favorite car. Mitchell took me for a ride in it. And I think the neatest thing that Ed Welburn did was commission the restoration of it.
And it is,
to this day, absolutely spectacular.
It's drop-dead beautiful.
It's beautiful, and the size of it, people don't understand.
How small it is.
The other car, of course, that I had a chance to drive on the Tech Center roads was the Corvair Monza GT Coupe. Which was a beautiful little car, as you recall, and I remember
Did double duty. The front clip also served double duty as the nose of the Chaparral 2C.
Yes, absolutely. Amen to that. And I remember taking Myron Scott of Chevrolet PR for a ride in that car around the tech center. There's a nice, long, fast right-hander behind the styling staff.
Right, that was particularly good.
And Scotty said to me, "Oh, so this is sports carring." I said, "Yes, sir, it certainly is."
Those two cars, the GT in silver and the SS Spider were in red. Stunning.
Yeah.
Yep. Hey, we've got a phone call here. Ben, let's bring it in.
Hey, John. As always, great show. Enjoy watching it every week. I've got a question for you regarding the Chinese auto industry. I was wondering if there's a go-to source or any kind of readily accessible source to kind of dig into the details, or if you happen to know the financial status of the Chinese auto industry in regards to the joint venture type companies like SAIC versus the smaller ones that we hear that have millions and millions of units of capacity. Any information that would be good to hear. I really am very curious to learn what you think. Is the Chinese auto industry becoming a paper tiger, or is it really what a lot of other people think, that it's the real deal and it's going to continue to grow for the next decade? Thank you very much.
Yeah, great question. It's the real deal. I mean, for sure, there's a lot of fly-by-nights in the Chinese auto industry, but there's some real serious players. I'd highly recommend that you check out Autoline this week, our television program, but you can get it on the website. I think it'll be up tomorrow afternoon. My guest is a guy named Michael Dunn, who I consider one of the foremost experts in the world on the Chinese automotive industry. He just wrote a book called American Wheels, Chinese Roads. Anybody and everybody who has any interest in the automotive industry should read that book. It is an eye-opener. And then the only other thing that I can possibly recommend is about once a month or so, J.D. Power publishes a report looking at what's going on in the Chinese industry. If you can get a hold of that, I'd recommend reading that. Carl, I don't know if you've got any sources or recommendations for learning about the Chinese auto industry.
I was going to mention Michael. Michael Dunn, I know Michael. I've worked with him. And he's consolidated his position as a real expert on the Asian industry in general. I mean, I think he's Hong Kong-based. I can't remember exactly, but he is based out there, and he does know the scene extremely well. I don't have any other thoughts on that information, you know. But it's always a tug of war between the Chinese car companies and their government. The government, in some phases, is willing to allow joint venture programs, and in other cases, it holds back. And so it's a delicate situation. And I guess the guys are pulling up in front of the ministry with their long wheelbase limos, trying to persuade them to let them do various things. But they are the real deal, no question.
I actually think the consumerist society is going to grow in China to the point where the government won't be able to stop it.
Right, I agree.
Good point.
DC Auto Geek says, he says, wasn't Callum with Jaguar? Good question, because we were talking about Morey Callum, who's at Ford, and his brother Ian Callum is at Jaguar. So, different Callum. Jim wants to know, why does Germany produce so many great automotive engineers?
Well, an engineer is respected in Germany. You have a title, you have a degree, you're a very serious person, and they have terrific companies to work for in the industry that respect engineering. Engineering is an important role in, you know, BMW is basically run by engineers. You've got organizations there that greatly respect and value what an engineer can bring to the company. So it's a terrific environment for an engineer to operate in. I think it's a combination of things, but those are two important parts.
Mm-hmm. Another question for Carl. With all the talk of sending auto assembly back to the U.S. lately, will there ever be any mainstream production in the U.K. again? I know you still have Mini and the Highline cars, but is there ever going to be production of family-type cars?
Yes, we have substantial production. At the moment, the Nissan factory in the UK, I think it's making about 450,000 units a year. Last year, to my surprise, I think Mini made 285,000 cars in the UK. The U.S. is the biggest market for the Mini, believe it or not, and also Toyota and Honda are large producers of cars in the U.K. So we're doing all right in the U.K. as car producers. We don't own any of these companies, but the U.K. is doing very well in terms of car manufacture these days. Thank you very much.
Yeah, you know, I've always said that as long as the design, engineering, development, and manufacturing is taking place there, who cares who owns it?
Well, there's much to be said for that. I agree with that.
Hey, we've got another phone call. Let's bring that in, Ben.
Hey, John Rick from San Diego. Yeah, I was wondering if you could ask Carl's thoughts on, as far as Opel's profitability, if they would make a 3-Series competitor based off the ATS or the Alpha Pro platform, since Opel will sell much higher volume cars in Europe than Cadillac will. I mean, Cadillac may make it, but it's going to take probably about 10 years. But Opel should sell very well, if it had a legitimate 3-Series player. Any thoughts?
Any thoughts about that, Carl? A 3-Series
competitor? That's a terrific idea. I mean, the new Cadillac is a rear drive platform, isn't it? I mean, that's the USP for that. And that's, as I said earlier, Opel and Vauxhall are hurting because they don't really have a senior car in there. There's no Opel Diplomat or, you know, no top of the range vehicle really. And that could be packaged in a different way. It could be a senior car of exceptional value for both Vauxhall and Opel. That's an interesting concept to think about doing that. Good idea.
There you go, Rick. Well, hey,
I've got one more question for Carl.
Yeah.
So, Carl, what's your top 3 racing cars of all time? You can have 6 or 8.
Alfa Romeo,
it's okay.
Alfa Romeo Type 158-59, the Launch D50, and let's see, what's the third? Well, the 1914 Mercedes that swept the French Grand Prix in that year. Terrific car.
Okay.
Swept the French Grand Prix and then won Indy the next year, did it not?
Amen. Very good. Well done, John. Yes, sir.
Because I think Ralph De Palma bought one of the winning cars. Here's a story that I've been trying to track down forever, okay? I found this in a magazine, circa an old magazine. This would have been circa 1917. Ralph, and the story is, Mercedes goes, wins the French Grand Prix. This is like May of 1914, literally just weeks before the war breaks out. Ralph De Palma buys one of the cars. I don't know if it was the winning car or not.
No, it wasn't the winning car, but anyway, yes.
Puts it on a ship. It heads to the States. The war breaks out. Meanwhile, the War Department in the United States is saying, we need a new engine. We need an engine for our planes. We need an engine for this tank that we're working on. They were even looking at putting them in submarine chasers, PT boats of the day. So supposedly, the War Department says, we need an engine. They contract the Packard Motor Company to build it, design and build it. And so, allegedly, according to this article, Packard goes in to Ralph De Palma and says, hey, we want to borrow your race car for a while. Take the engine down, copy everything, build it back up with a few tweaks of their own design, and that was the Liberty engine. And, Carl, I read this, and I've been trying for over a decade now to verify any of this. Nobody knows the story.
John, I don't think that story holds water. Okay. The Liberty was developed between Hall Scott and Packard, and Packard had already built some aero engines of quite sophisticated design. And when they locked themselves up in a hotel room, they worked with what they knew, Packard and Hall Scott, and they didn't really have time to look at that. Although in one respect, De Palma was very close to Packard, and in fact, when he raced the Mercedes, I think it had a Packard adapted carburetor, for example. So he had some help from Packard. Hmm. But I think it worked that way rather than the other way around. The story that goes around in the UK is that one of the cars was on display in a showroom in London when the war broke out, and that car was taken up to Rolls-Royce to be examined and looked at, and that it influenced some of the things that Rolls-Royce did. I think now we're learning that was a little bit after the fact, that it was an earlier six-cylinder engine that Mercedes had that Rolls-Royce took a look at. So we're still trying to sort that one out. But there is definitely a case of Mercedes engineering influencing Rolls-Royce in the creation of the Eagle V12, which was their first big, serious aero engine for the First World War. So that's the way it worked. We know that there was some influence there for sure.
So, Carl, one last question. What's your favorite all-time Porsche racing car?
Oh, boy. Well, I am a fan of the 908-3, you know, the little car that they built for the Targa Florio and the Nürburgring, which had fiberglass so thin you could see through it.
And, not to mention the driver's feet ahead of the front axle.
Oh yeah, it was a hazardous little vehicle, but it sure was a brilliant piece of engineering. I'm a big fan of that car.
Yeah, that's my favorite.
Yeah, I'm also pretty keen on the TAG V6 that was developed for use by McLaren. And my latest version of my book, Excellence Was Expected, tells the story of that engine and that cooperation, I think, in a way that isn't told anywhere else in the world of Porsche. So just a little plug there. Sorry about that.
I'll want to read that. I definitely will. Well, Carl, we're going to wrap it up, but it's been sensational having you on the show here. It's just
really
been terrific.
Enjoyed it.
It's great to see you, Carl.
Thanks a lot, Peter.
And you've motivated me. I got to come back in here this weekend and start going through my files and dig up that old story about, you know, possibly Packard looking at the Mercedes Grand Prix engine.
Okay.
But, Carl, what a pleasure. It's been just terrific.
Thanks for asking me.
That's great. Well, Peter, it's been great having you here, too.
No, it was a really good show.
Really good show. So, folks, we're going to wrap it up here. Remember, you can always find us on Facebook at facebook.com/Out of Line Detroit. You can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/Out of Line. Same with Peter's stuff. Go to twitter.com/AutoExtremist, or better yet, just go to AutoExtremist.com. You can always subscribe to all of our things for free on our website. Check it out. Don't forget that tomorrow there's going to be Roundabout starting at 6:30 p.m. We're going to be off next week because I'm going to the D.C. Auto Show. In fact, next Thursday during the day, we'll be webcasting live from the D.C. show. We've got some pretty high-level politicians and regulators and other industry people. You might want to check that out. But, oh, yeah, and if you've got any questions that you want to have us asking at that auto show, make sure that you send them now. Ben just weighed in on that and send it to John's Journal, right, as I keep repeating what Ben's telling me to say here. But anyway, folks, thanks so much for joining us. We'll see you in 2 weeks.
And good night or good morning, Simon, wherever you are.
Wherever you are.
Visit our website, outofline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 7 p.m. Eastern. Get your daily automotive news fix with Out of Line Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Out of Line Detroit. That's all there and much more at outofline.tv.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone. Your journey, our passion. And by Chevrolet. Chevy runs deep.